That the last time Jamar came in the fall, we were energized after, while you were here and after you left. And immediately we were on such like a high from that, from talking about the spirit of justice and also just being in the room together where you kind of feel like I'm not alone. I'm not the only one who's looking for this, thinks of this, we're okay, we're gonna find this. And afterwards, I think pretty immediately we started saying, when can he come back again? So we didn't have a conversation of, is that too much, Jamar? Is there such a thing as too much, Jamar, right? But we it's on. But we wanted to make sure that you came back as soon as possible. And I think we started talking about it right away. Like the next day, we're like, when can you come again? You have these other books coming out. We'd love to have you come back. And the reason really why, Jamar, is because you've become a friend to Spark and we've known each other for many years. But I would say Spark and Spark adjacent folk here, it has felt hard since November. And I think some of us have maybe thought, maybe it won't be as bad as I think it's going to be. Maybe I'll wait. And then sure enough, even when we were looking at the date to bring you, because we had the conversation that like 2 days after the election, he and I were talking. And at that time, we thought, okay, maybe come right away when this releases early January. And like, well, you'd be coming, that's around January 6th. We don't want, and then we'd say, well, we could have you come on the weekend of January 19th. We're like, let's not get anywhere near the 20th. So we were already pre-mourning back in November and trying to figure out how to wrap around those dates. And our next free date was this date. And even as we were coming through this last month and going through those different sort of milestones, I would kept thinking about that conversation and how back in November we knew it was going to be hard and we were planning then for how we might feel now. And I was just letting Jamar know that I sense a difference in all y'all and in this room from his visit last fall, just a few months ago, to today. But the opening pages of your latest book, and we have them all here and available for purchase in the back. The opening pages of The Spirit of Justice. Did you know that this book is dedicated to y'all? They didn't know they're mentioned here. To all those who are weary and heavy laden, be encouraged. You, this book, and your visit today are on time. Thank you for being with us. We feel less alone already. Yeah.
Well, first of all, thank you, Spark and extended family. It's really good to be, I mean, one of the only comforts in this time is to be among like-minded folks, to feel that you're not alone. And thank you for reminding me of that dedication. All my other books are dedicated to particular people by name, but this book and these stories, I wanted to be a sort of deep sigh of peace in the midst of a storm to all those who are weary and heavy laden. So I thought that this might be a timely book. I wish it wasn't quite so timely. But it really truly is designed for how we feel right now. And I mean, there's just these folks on the cover, most of whom most people can't name.
Remind us again.
Yes. So in the center is Coretta Scott King, who I can go on and on about her, but what we know about her husband is largely due to her. Within 2 months, she had started the King Center in Atlanta, which is now headed by their youngest daughter, Bernice King. She also had the wherewithal to preserve his papers, speeches, mementos, memorabilia, which are both at the King Center and here at Stanford, at the King's Institute. And then she becomes a human rights activist in her own right, particularly around the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa, anti-nuclear war movement, all that stuff. To her left is the other woman, Anna Murray Douglas, who I talk about in the book. She's Frederick Douglass's first wife. She helps him escape. She's a seamstress. She sews the sailor's uniform that he uses as a disguise when he gets on the train north. Douglass is an escaped fugitive, and she takes him into her home, which meant she could have been arrested had they been caught. And by the way, it's just an interesting fact of history. Douglass never is, like, emancipated. He has to, white people in Europe pool their money together to buy his freedom. So his enslaver still makes money. It's just one of these things. And then anyway, Anna Marie Douglass raises their children. And because Douglass is a famous fugitive, he actually has to go to Europe for 2 years. And she's on her own with the kids. So she's an incredible human being. And then on the far right, the only man on the cover is a guy named Elias Camp Morris, E.C. Morris, who is an absolute institution in terms of religious history that no one knows about. So I learned about Elias Camp Morris because I lived in Helena, Arkansas, which is where his church, Centennial Baptist Church, was. Now, the reason E.C. Morris is important is because after the Civil War, one of the first things black people did was form their own churches and fellowships. It took 20 years or more for them to coalesce into denominations. And so three different networks came together in 1895 and formed the National Baptist Convention, USA, Inc. It's what it's now known as. The first president of NBC, which is the largest black religious organization in the country, the first president was E.C. Morris. He was president from 1895 until his death in 1922. If you think about that, you know, that's 20 plus years leading the largest black religious organization in the country from the Delta of Arkansas. And nobody knows his name. So the NBC is the denomination Daddy King was part of. The NBC is the denomination MLK was a part of till 1962 when they broke off and formed the Progressive National Baptist Convention. The NBC is still the largest religious black organization in the country, and he was the first president. So I want us to remember these stories. Because if the color of compromise is like the story of white people behaving badly around race, the spirit of justice is the flip side and the story of black Christian agency in the midst of injustice.
And I think if you guys haven't picked up on it, what it seems like you've done in these stories, and I have my favorites now that I kind of go back to again and again, is you've highlighted, as you mentioned earlier, like people we haven't heard of before, but for whom we wouldn't be here without them.
That's right.
And I'd love for you to make a little bit of a connection, because I think what a lot of folks, and we're going to give you all time to ask questions, but I think one of the questions I hear all of you asking all the time is, well, now what are we going to do, right? Should we react to every crazy thing that's being sent out and being shared? What's the next right thing? We were talking about this last week at Spark, that which we give attention, we give power. So what are we going to give power over our lives? How do we just sort of let some things go because we can't do anything about it? We have no agency there, but figure out where our place of activism is. Mm-hmm. And you've mentioned already persons that we don't naturally go to or stick their face right up on the coin or whatever it is we're going to do or dress up as, getting ready for whatever, right? So what is your next step, or some of the things that you mentioned, I think your sermon covered this, about what people can start looking to do in order to embrace that spirit of justice in their own life?
I do believe that we ought to be very aggressive in not ceding ground to white Christian nationalists. In other words, do not let them lay claim to Christianity. It is not theirs. I'll let terms like evangelical go. I'll let terms like reformed go. I will not let the term Christianity go. And so I do think it is within all of our purview to say this, the Christianity of Christ, not that, white Christian nationalism. So what does that require? You got to learn what white Christian nationalism actually looks like. If you follow my Instagram, I'm posting a lot on it. I posted recently a side-by-side chart. On the left, the Christianity of Christ. I use that language from Frederick Douglass. On the right, white Christian nationalism. And I say different things to compare and contrast them. I also posted a study from Public Religion Research Institute, which you should follow, PRRI. And they do, this is what they do from a sociological standpoint. And they, I listed the diagnostic questions that they ask on surveys. The degree of your adherence to these questions determines the degree of Christian nationalism, which, by the way, is not a binary, you are or you aren't. It's a spectrum. And it there's also a circle graph that shows what percentage of the population is on which point in the spectrum, right? So we got to do our homework is what I'm trying to say. And then when we see people like Pete Hegseth claim to be Christian and because he's Christian is sexist, violent, racist, we say, that's not Christ. This is, you know, it's a violation of all kinds of commandments, but I think it's helpful to remember it's explicitly a violation of the third commandment, not to take the Lord's name in vain, which obviously is not just about, not about swearing, right? Cussing. It's about doing things in the name of God that God would never condone. And that's what white Christian nationalism does. So that's one of the areas. Another area, I'm passionate about this, it was one of my sermon points in September when I came, is about your spiritual gifts. I cannot emphasize this enough. None of us can do everything. All of us can do something. And more than that, all of us can uniquely do something. So if we are actually spiritual about religion and not just cognitive as we love to be, if we're actually spiritual about it, we believe the passage in Corinthians that says God gave us a spiritual gift. Can you identify that? Have you gone through a process of discernment to say, what is it? And then in the beginning of that whole passage where it lists these spiritual gifts, the first verse in that passage says, you're given these gifts for a purpose for the common good. So the twofold job we have right now, I think in this time when we're trying to figure out what to do, is to number one, figure out what is our spiritual gift? And number two, how do we apply it for the common good? So for me, that's meant, all right, Jamar, just kind, time to just own it. You're a teacher. So what do teachers do? I research and I teach. I communicate it. So what am I committing to right now? Studying authoritarianism, studying oligarchy, translating it specifically for the church so that we do have some tools. But my gift's not your gift. So you have homework to do to figure out as a follower of Christ, what gift has the Holy Spirit given you and how do you apply it to for the common good?
My dear friend Rabbi Chaim and his wife Karen are here. And I'm reminded of the quote in Talmud, right? We are not under the obligation. Can you give me the exact quote? But neither are we free to, we are not under obligation to do all of the work. How does it exactly work, right? But we are not allowed to, we're not free of the obligation of doing something, right, starting, yeah. And so I think this idea of like we can feel overwhelmed, there's too much for us to do, there's nothing I can do, there's no way I can make a change in this big thing, right? But that doesn't mean we're free to not do anything. We still have to do something in it, yeah. Yeah. And I love that idea because I think what you're, book has done, and also in your How to Fight Racism series, it's like, what is the thing that you can do in these various different ways? And I feel like I could help you with a book about sparkers. And I mean it in a sincere way. Like, I look out and I think, that's somebody who's teaching, and they're making sure they're teaching in an area where kids are marginalized, where there's not enough access, and they're making sure that when they come here on Sunday, they're getting prepared to go back and do that great good work throughout the week. Pastor Mark, who, you know, has a Master's of Divinity and takes all of our kids and gives them incredible pearls of wisdom, you know, for years now, he still, with Kwame and others, organizes the silent protest 1 month a week with Etsniks that join. So I think that there's these ways in which we do it together, all of us together, and it adds up when we're all together.
I mean, we really do have to recalibrate our calculations about justice. So often we think about justice is the big thing, the march, the protest, the boycott, right? And we often evaluate the effectiveness of justice is whether we win. Does the law change? Does the policy change? Does the person get elected? There's a whole lot of the Bible, most of the Bible, that is written in the context of exile, oppression, injustice. And it's not about necessarily winning against those earthly powers. It's how to be faithful in the midst of it. So when I say we need to recalibrate, that's what I mean. So I think what we're witnessing, and I don't think it's overstating that, is the real death of democracy, the rise of authoritarianism and oligarchy on these very shores. And it's not that we shouldn't try to prevent it, it's just that it might not work. And yet and still, we are called to be faithful in the midst of that. So when we recalibrate, you actually have to look for those tiny signs of light and hope and love. And we're used to looking at the big picture. And also we have this, in the U.S., kind of triumphalist view of religion and nation. We're not used to losing like this. This is for other countries.
Well, we also don't pay attention that the boycott was how many days, right?
381 days.
381 days. And that seems like significantly successful given how much history.
Yeah.
I mean, the women who fought for the right to vote did so for decades. Not once, twice, not one good march on Washington, right? It was over and over again. And for those of us who haven't practiced this because we never thought we were going to have to live during these times, so we thought we were exceptional, that in the last time this happened, some of us got out our marching shoes. And it was the first time for many of us. And we were really grateful that the generation that of Etsniks who had marched in the 70s, 60s, 70s, were ready with some songs. Because the rest of us Sparkers just stood there like, oh, now what do? We got organized. Now we're standing in this corner to protest separation of children at the border. But now what do? And the Etsniks were like, we got some songs for you. And we got to sing some songs together. Afterwards, some of you all said, what did we accomplish? What was the point of that? We went out. We stood there. Some people honked. Some people yelled. Some people didn't like what we were saying. I mean, the news came. What did we accomplish? And I went back and I was like, okay, let me make a list. You now know that you can look in the mirror and say, I'm the kind of person who, when I find out this is happening, I'm not going to stand for it. And guess what else? My neighbor now knows that I'm the kind of person who. And my kids know. This next generation, this is why this is so important, and we're so glad you're here to speak to our kids, because our kids need to know that they're going to have to do this too, and that when they look back and go, my goodness, that was some deep injustice that happened in those 2000s. Where were you, Mom? Like, oh, I got a picture. We're out, and we're all together, and we're doing the work together. And so, a policy didn't change, but I was changed. And the community was changed. And then some people started coming to this community just because they saw the news. Yep. They're like, I didn't think there were any Christians who cared about this, but now I know that there are.
I think that's key. What changed? I'm the type of person who. That is what we as believers bring to the table. We are the kind of people who live like Christ, who do what Jesus has taught us to do. And those kinds of things that may not change a whole bunch in the world do change us, so that we become the kind of people who are witnesses. And because of that witness, like, we actually have a way better message than white Christian nationalists.
Thank
God. It is so much more compelling. Love, acceptance, forgiveness, unity. That's actually what you have to offer. But we can't just do it in word. We have to do it in deed. And we can't just do it in deed. We have to embody it in our character. And that's the kind of people who make it into these books, right? So it really is about we become the type of people who. I think that's
important. And we can't do it alone. It's going to be too hard.
Yeah.
It's going to be too hard. So we expect a call. We're bringing you back so we can all get in the room again.
Well, can I just say, like, to highlight a point that I tried to make, this is not business as usual. Please do not believe anyone who is banking on the midterms or the next presidential election. The way autocracies work is they use legitimate democratic means to get in power, then they dismantle those democratic means to stay in power. It's really bizarre to me that more people don't look at states like Mississippi, and an increasing number of states, actually. But this is the state with the highest proportion of black people in the U.S., nearly 40% of the state's population, and it has had a Republican supermajority for years. It has effectively enshrined a type of minority rule in the sense that a very small cadre of people makes all the rules for everybody for the benefit of just that small group of people. And that's been happening for decades now. And we've seen it on the state level. It's now happening on the federal level to a greater extent. This is not just about U.S. officials colluding with one another. They're colluding with other oligarchs internationally. There are literal secret meetings of multi-billionaires from around the country to plot and plan and literally carve up the globe about who's going to take which area and how and when and how to support each other in doing it, because it will benefit them and they will have power. I'm just trying to paint a picture because I'm in conversation with the folks who either study this or are living it. And what we have been used to in our politics, as toxic as it has been, this is far worse. So, one, I hope to disabuse us of any sort of, it's not going to be so bad, or maybe it'll be better than we think. Probably not. It'll probably be worse. It'll probably be faster than we think happening. And two, to have us gear up for this. Yes, resist, but also maybe it doesn't go the way we want. And I think that's the key. The other key difference is I don't think it's really helpful right now to say we've been here before, because a lot's different. History is the study of continuity and discontinuity. There's some things that are continuous, like white supremacy and racism and exclusion broadly. But there's a lot that's different. Twice impeached president who now has lost an election and is now back in power, therefore thinks has a mandate, right? A media and social media landscape that supercharges ignorance and hatred. We've just never had that technology before. Even the levels of wealth that we're seeing and the concentration among such a small group, historically high. So, and then something like a Project 2025, which they are enacting by the letter, all that's different. And I think it deserves, like we can't effectively resist it if we don't actually acknowledge it. And that's just unfortunate. Like, I wish I had a more rah-rah message.
Yes, but on that note. But I think what you mentioned in one of your Substacks was we shouldn't just say we've been here before, because there's some very important distinctions, but we can say what?
We're built for this.
We're built for this.
Yeah. And this was Reverend Tracy Blackman, who was on the ground. She's a pastor in Ferguson when it all went down. And she, on MLK Day slash Inauguration Day, I was at a invite-only gathering of Black Christian leaders, and she gave this analogy. She was talking about the fires in LA. There's this one particular home that had survived the fire while all the homes around it had burned. And as the journalist dug into it, it turns out that the owner of the house had prepared the house to resist the fire. Concrete barriers, bushes so far from the home, different materials on the roof, all of that stuff, and it worked. And she used that, she had an actual picture of the house up, and she used that to say, as people of faith, we are built for moments like these. We are built to withstand the fire. By which she meant we have the resources. Somebody made the very apt point, not everyone's as ready as everyone else. Because I think the degree of your intentionality leading up to this point has prepared you or left you unprepared for this moment. But the raw materials are still there. And so it's not to say that we're without hope, but we got to prepare.
Can I brag about Spark for 2 minutes?
Yeah.
Y'all, it's something that was apparent to me the last time around, and I know this time's different. But what we did that time was we invited, right after the first election that was disturbing, we invited Rabbi Ari and Samina Sundas of American Voices of Peace and Justice, and we invited all of our allies, and we had our undocumented members, and we had our queer members, and we were already here together, and we sang songs together, and we kind of said, yes, this is scary, and we are still going to follow the way of Jesus, and we're still going to embrace love, reputation of God, reconciliation, rescue, and resurrection. These things haven't changed. And what I saw you all do 8 years ago, and since Sparks began, and this goes for Etsniks too, I've seen it too, is that we show up to the moment. You guys have been kind of built for this. You're here for this. And for those of you who are Spark adjacent, I want to say, you're in this room. You're here. You're built for it too. But I was very grateful that when that happened, we didn't say, oh, gee, let's go find a Muslim person who might feel scared right now and just prop them up in front of everybody. Like, let's go find a rabbi who might be able to be a friend and show up. These, we were already doing it. We were already supporting undocumented persons. We were already trying to welcome strangers and refugees. You had already been here. You didn't show up. Every month is Black History Month at Spark. You know, you didn't show up just because, right? And so I just want to encourage you all. Yes, this is going to be hard. You're sobering me up here, Jamar. I'm a little bit, it's going to be hard to sleep. But I'm very grateful to be in this room with a community that I do think, as people of faith, and also just as people here who are struggling to try to listen, to learn, to re-examine our story on Sundays, and all of those things, that we're Jesus is with us, we've got this, Spirit of Justice is here.
I think that, you know, that what you talked about last week, what you give attention to is what you give power. Somebody said they weren't going to let Trump take up more space in their mind than Jesus, and that stuck with me. I was like, oh, dang. because like, what was I really thinking about the most? And so that was a helpful reminder. I'll say, in both of these books, there's really helpful notes for parents. Yes. That one in the back, and then there's an author's note in the front of Stories of the Spirit of Justice, which doesn't get enough love because kids that age, they don't have the little cute 5-year-old thing to them anymore. This is for 8 to 12-year-olds.
But Rabbi I'm really Hines proud of this book. Enjoying this book, yeah.
I'm very proud of this. And I just think it's really readable. So it's not divided into chapters so much as historical eras. And then at the beginning of each historical era, there's a little historical context, like a page and a half, 2 pages, and then you get into these sort of mini biographies, and they're super fantastic. Readable, 2 or 3 pages, so you can do it like right before bed or at the dinner table. And I'll send y'all this, but there's actually a guide we created that says which figures are in this book and which figures are in the adult book and which pages each is on, so you can read along with the young people. The other thing I want to emphasize is I don't do this 100% of the time, but I often try to say adults and kids, because you don't have to have your own children for this to be applicable. You can be somebody who works with kids, an aunt, an uncle, a sibling. If you have younger people in your life you care about, this is for you, and this is for them. So I just want to do that while we...
First, thank you so much for your very powerful sermon and the generosity you have in, you know, teaching. So as you can hear, I'm not from here, so you might disagree with what I'm going to say as a historian, but my little understanding is that a lot of the people here who are Christian vote on one issue, one topic, which is abortion, nothing else. Whoever is, and they are going to be voting Republican, whether someone is impeached or not. So this is the only thing that they're voting on. So I'm just wondering, you know, as a historian and a theologian, how do you navigate that when you speak with people who, regardless of who is in, you know, running for president, they're going to vote for that particular issue?
Well, I agree with your assessment. Yes, there have been a lot of single issue voters, which you might say got us into this mess. I would point folks to the work of historian Randall Balmer, who I cite in The Color of Compromise, when we talk about how abortion became that one issue and how it was really linked to excluding Christian institutions from their tax-exempt status because they refused to give up racial segregation. So that story is there. You say, how do I talk to them? They don't listen to me. One of the things that has changed in the past 8 to 9 years since the first Trump presidency was, or even since The Color of Compromise came out, I could get a hearing in some really conservative spaces that was like, let's hear them out. Let's have the conversation. No more. Like, no more. So the rift, and that's just an example, but the rift has gotten so much bigger. I'm not having those conversations, honestly. And in my view, it's going to be white people who have those relationships who could possibly get a hearing. Now, if you want a helpful tool for that, Caleb Campbell has written a book called Disarming Leviathan. Caleb Campbell has a really interesting story. In high school, he was a neo-Nazi skinhead. He was also a drummer. And he was looking for gigs, and he just so happened to get a gig at a church. And it was through drumming at a church that he eventually converted to Christianity, gave up all that racism, but then, as he went on and became a minister himself, he actually crafted a role as a new kind of missionary, a missionary to white Christian nationalists. And so he would literally go to their gatherings and their churches and sort of become immersed in the culture so that he could subversively interject ideas that were healthier, right? And now he's written a book about how to do that. And he's basically saying the very frustrating answer that is going to take long, patient, loving, relational work to help persuade people. But that's not everyone's work. That ain't my work per se. I will not be going to those conferences. But there are still people, again, this goes back to what is your gifting? There are still people who are called to that kind of work.
And just a quick note, Randall Balmer was at Spark a few years ago, and you can watch his learning seminar with us, and his books are also in the library in Spark.
Thank you. Jamar, you said something a couple of days ago with regards to black intellectual traditions. And so unfortunate, there's the whole challenge of disinformation and misinformation, and with the access to the internet, where we were never supposed to have that much access to people's crazy thoughts. What are those things that you would say to us to help us navigate the present reality into the future?
So connect the first part of your statement with the black intellectual tradition.
So I'm a little older. So some of the things, I grew up with Saturday Academy. So a lot of the history that we learned about who we were and not just the colonizer's version of that history was taught to us by people like those that you've mentioned in your book. But there are a lot of folks that can share that knowledge that we can go out and follow, because NBC, CNN, all those folks, they can be paid for. Who are those people that you are following that will help us be able to gather the necessary intelligence to be able to navigate the times in which we find ourselves?
Who are the people? Okay. I mean, you can go on my socials and see who I follow. But follow the historians. Here's my soapbox about Black History Month. We're doing it wrong. The way we approach Black History Month is, let me get 30 factoids about Black people. It's random, it's scattered. You actually lose the beauty and gravity of history because you're not viewing it as a narrative, you're viewing it as disconnected data points on a timeline. It's a story. So I say follow the historians because you're going to get such a different picture of any history, and specifically Black history, if you can follow a narrative arc and not this data here, this fact here, this did you know here. This is why people don't like history. It's because I have to memorize a whole bunch of disconnected dots on a line and not the dramatic human true stories that history really is about. So where do you want to start? I mean, start easy. Make it fun and exciting for you. Is there a period in history? Is there a biography or a person? And actually read through it or listen to it, right? I love listening to audio. That counts as reading, you know? So that's one big thing. Keisha Blaine is a historian who I really respect and admire. She's writing about international women's Pan-African activism. She's got a brand new book coming out soon, Keisha Blaine. Nicole Hannah-Jones is an investigative journalist. Her work's going to be re-emphasized because she led up the 1619 Project. And now with the 1776 Advisory Committee coming back, her work's going to be back in the headlines. They're just countless. But if you want, honestly, what I often tell people is start with the endnotes in either of these books, especially in the parts that like interest you. Just go to the endnotes, and I've referenced a bunch of authors and books and talks and things of that nature.
Hi, Dr. Tisby. I wanted to ask about how to help our children navigate the season. I know you've talked to us in the congregation as adults. I think it's very different having young children. I'm thinking a lot about their future. We are very open in our household, so we had the inauguration on. I was helping them with their questions, but I could also see they were really afraid for what they were hearing. So how do you balance the soberness of this moment with the hopefulness of what we can do as people who follow God? And how do we put that in little kid language? Like I said, I have a 5'8" and a almost 2-year-old.
That's a question, isn't it? My son's 14. We listen to the news when we go to school. He hears it. On his own, he started asking questions, which was great. Honestly, I treat it like the sex talk. Honest and age appropriate, right? What we don't want is to let some other source educate our kids on this. So what I would say is whatever you can do coming from you is going to be better than what they'll absorb, right? The other thing is really important is your kids are a bit young, but not that young, to really watch their media consumption. It is mind-boggling, and I saw this as a teacher. I was first a teacher in the age before social media, and that is like primeval era compared to now. Even my last time as a principal was back in the mid-2010s, and to see that you would have fights break out, like real life fights break out over text messages. Like it's just a whole different landscape. And so we have to be extremely careful about that. Balancing the hope, I really think that's gonna come through with the way we live and the way we talk. Is there gonna be a note or a tinge of like, we're built for this? Or this is bad and we can't do anything about it. So I actually think, you know, James Baldwin said, the children have never been very good at listening to what the adults say, but they've never failed to follow what they do, paraphrasing. And that's key. I don't think a lot of it is going to come with the right phraseology. It will come, oh, we go to Spark. We talk about these things. We remember the deeds of the Lord. Those kinds of things come through. What would you say?
Agreed. I think also hope and joy are disciplines. So these things don't come because we look at the news and go, that's fantastic, right? It comes from something bigger and different than that. And we have to practice it. It's a practice. And a year ago, we went through a 6-7 week program just on compassion and practice. Practicing, it's based on the teachings of Jesus and Dr. King and others, practicing staying grounded when we're upset about something, and then staying in conversation, loving conversation with a beloved other that's ticking you off, and a difficult other that's making you mad or hurting you. And how do we do that? And it's about how Dr. King and others stayed grounded in their nonviolent resistance, even when things were very, very bad. And I think what I learned from all of that is this is practice. Mm-hmm. It's practice. You don't accidentally find yourself being joyful, loving, and hopeful when things are hard. You have to practice it. And it doesn't mean, I don't think it means just being naive. It's not about that at all. But it's a practice. And so that book, Compassion and Practice, is by Frank Rogers. And I believe our dear, wonderful Felicia is going to be helping a group go through that in a couple months. So I would find people to practice and then show that to your kids. Were you, like, if we would all, quote unquote, win if we could do self-control and problem solving, right? So when we do these spiritual practices of staying grounded and staying intact when we're really upset about things, our kids are going to watch that.
Hi, I'm going to do a two-part question, sorry. First, I'm most discouraged by the erosion of journalism and facts, and I'm just wondering if you have any tips for just interacting with people in our orbit who, like, I have, where I grew up in central Illinois is Trump country, and all of the Christians watch Newsmax, and there's... to even get them out of that world is its own thing. So I know that's a loaded question, but any advice you have? And then two, just a very practical thing. I've read on social media that some people are saying, oh, we shouldn't protest because they want you to protest so then he can declare martial law. Is there any truth to that? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yes. Yeah, the news part is really concerning. Which office was it that they kicked out? It's mainstream news, and they brought in OANN and some of these other ones. They just did that. Which is just, I mean, it's worst case scenario because now they're exerting even more control over the organs of journalism. So we can't even truly know what's going on. So what's happening now, you see all these journalists leaving the Post, the Times, CNN, NBC, most of them are starting Substacks. We're going to have to actually literally financially support these individuals because the institutions have been bought and paid for by billionaires. So that media landscape looks different. And so we're going to have to find sites of authority for information that are non-traditional. You're asking about sort of breaking through to people who consume this far-right propaganda, is I think the better term. It's not a quick fix because we all know if you try to rebut them with facts and truth and data, it's a brick wall. Because what we're dealing with fundamentally is not about intellect but identity. They're getting a sense of identity, belonging, even community from what they're believing. So a book I'll recommend to just at least unpack this is called The Religion of Whiteness. The Religion of Whiteness by Michael Emerson, who co-wrote Divided by Faith, and another sociologist, Glenn Bracey, that just came out several months ago. And it's a really provocative thesis in that they're saying, following off of some foundational sociological theory, is that what white people are worshiping when white people get together is whiteness. And they describe it as the feeling of effervescence in the room. When you get in a place where all the people believe the same thing and are all on the same page, and there's that effervescence that they're trying to preserve and even extend into society, that this is the way things should be. So again, it's a provocative thesis, lots of data, agree or disagree, but it's a way of, I think it really is effective for helping us understand this is going beyond, oh, I read a bunch of stuff on the far right and now I'm convinced by it. That's not what's happening. Yeah. And you had a second part, the martial law. I do think, absolutely. So one of the things that sociology does tell us is that the higher your adherence to white Christian nationalism, the more likely you are to agree with the statement that true patriots may have to resort to violence to bring about desired political ends. Now that's just on the grassroots level. What's really scary is the people in power now are not just willing to use force and violence, they are gleeful about it. From everything I see, there are a handful of folks who are just waiting for a mass protest in order to unleash the military to quash it. Now, we've already seen this in spots, like with Black Lives Matter protesters. Now they're going to do it more generally in any sort of mass mobilization we might do. I absolutely think that is not only possible, but likely.
I'm curious about the relationship or connection between people's personal wealth and the likelihood that they'll push back on family members. Push back on family members who disagree with them, when they might feel that the government is behaving in an inhumane way, and then their family member that holds their financial future in their hands, who's going to bequeath, I can't think of the word, pass down their wealth to them, thinks differently, is maybe in agreement with that inhumane treatment. And when Dr. Tisby, when you mentioned that we're seeing unprecedented wealth gaps now, I was wondering, in your historical study, how have you noticed that people's personal wealth that gets passed down from generation to generation, not generation to generation, if it gets passed down, if they're affluent enough to have something passed down, how have people, what has been the likelihood of people resisting against their family members who might think a certain way when that family member holds their financial future in their hands?
So I think it's important that when we're talking about the current political landscape, oligarchs, plutarchs, we're not talking about merely rich people. We are talking about obscenely wealthy people. The obscenely wealthy are going to be fine. They will literally build a spaceship to Mars. Literally, just what they're working on, right? The merely rich eventually will feel all of this too. So if you're upper middle class, even a multimillionaire, but not like hundreds of millions, sorry. What you're talking about, though, I think fundamentally is drawing a line when your economic fortunes are dependent on the relationship. Well, what does the Bible say? I'll commend to you another book that's just coming out. It's called The Anti-Greed Gospel by Malcolm Foley. He's a professor and in the executive administration at Baylor University, Black scholar and pastor. We helped each other finish dissertations. We would get on Zoom calls at 6 a.m. and just write with each other on the screen. And, you know, he's really going back to the basics of what's really behind so much racism and injustice generally, which is a love of money. And so I commend that book to us as a reminder, as followers of Christ, that you cannot serve two masters. Like, it's not actually complicated morally. And I can speak from experience. I'll tell you the one thing that nearly took me out of ministry was raising money for our first national conference. I had to, it was hard because not all money is good money. So we couldn't go to the big evangelical Christian organizations that could write us a single check and underwrite the whole thing, because they weren't on board with our racial justice stance. So I would be calling, I mean, literally scrolling through my phone to contacts I hadn't talked to in years. Yo, we need some money. And not a little, you know, for individuals. Can you do $3,000? Can you do 50? And we didn't know up until probably 7 or 10 days before. We didn't even have enough money for the honoraria for the speakers. Like, we couldn't write them a check if they showed up. And anyway, my point being, I hated that, and I still do. I still get, like, jitters thinking about it, but it was the thing we had to do. And it made our lives so much harder because we wouldn't accept just any money from anyone. And I think we need to be more willing to do that. And actually, the body is set up to absorb some of that. There should be no one in need among you. So that when you do take that principled stance and you do lose economic stability, the body's supposed to come around and support you. Where did that go? And by the way, on top of it, when people take a principled public stance and lose their jobs, the body's supposed to come around. There have been professors who have literally lost their jobs for mentioning the color of compromise in their syllabi. Go back on my Substack, read about Julie Moore, Taylor University, read about Professor Sam Jockel at Palm Beach Atlantic, a stone's throw from Mar-a-Lago. If they lose their jobs because they're teaching about racial justice, they're not supposed to be destitute as Christians. And also, by the way, since you got me on
please
it,
go.
With this K through 12 teaching stuff, and they're not going to allow books like this, and they're always like, oh, we need to teach the Bible in school and whatnot. I'm like, cool, but teach the real history, which they won't do. And what we need are sort of Rosa Parks examples in the educational system of people willing to be fired for teaching truth. And then guess what? In the civil rights movement, they had things called freedom funds. So that if you were a marcher or a protester and you got jailed, it was a bail fund that they could use to, and guess what? People from across the country would contribute to this. And whenever somebody needed to get bailed out of jail because they were protesting injustice, there were resources to do that. We're going to need to do that. That's the level of protest we're at.
Well, and to your last time you were here, you shared that the algorithm has started suppressing anything to do with justice.
We can't get
racial justice
ads approved to advertise for this. It started in 2020 with the pandemic because there was so much misinformation about health and vaccines. It extended because the election was also that year. And I got a lot of traction with Color of Compromise because that came out January 2019 before all that stuff. But then my next book was How to Fight Racism. You couldn't get anything on social media for that. And now in 2025, post-inauguration, it's even harder. So this goes back to, if there are voices that you right now learn from and support, you need to take the next step and actually financially support them, because they're not going to pop up on your social media feed, or even if they're on yours, it's not going to spread beyond that. The media environment is absolutely bonkers right now, and it is tilted against truth-telling and justice. And the only way to prevent these voices from going away completely, all except the Dan Rathers of the world, right? The only way to prevent that is, like, we as consumers cease to become simply consumers and also support them. I'm passionate about, because this is my situation. Like, I work at Simmons College now, which is a faith-based HBCU. It's the first institution I've worked at where I haven't had to look over my shoulder for anything I say about race. But even then, higher ed is very shaky. So my backup plan is Substack. 5% of my subscribers are actually paying subscribers. The rest are consumer, which I'm happy to do, right? But in this season, we cannot simply count on the people providing good information to be able to keep doing that. And by the way, I'm not going to be in the first wave of folks they come after, but I won't be far behind in terms of the, especially because I talk about Christians. So you see how they did the Right Reverend Buddy at the National Cathedral. So what's happening is, it's not going to be enough to say you're Christian. You have to be their kind of Christian. And anyone who dares, as I called all of us to do, be witnesses of the Christianity of Christ, you're going to be separated. And if you're too loud or you go after their people too much, you will be targeted. How does that happen? They can shut you down on the internet. They can throttle your content. They can go after you personally. We've had to take security measures, digital security measures, to protect against that. Like, I'm just trying to give you a sense of how serious it is, especially for the people who are sort of vocal in public. But it's coming for all of us, in a sense.
Earlier today, I said to Jamar, hey, your schedule must be so busy right now. So much going on. So many people must want you to come and share. Thanks for squeezing us in. And you said, no, not so much. It's, people are afraid.
I want to go back to your comment about Mississippi, I think it was, 40% black population.
Yeah.
And contrast that to the oligarchy you're talking about. In our country, historically, we've seen an increase in diversity, an increase in minority population. From your historian perspective, can you think about, or can you talk about how you see that power structure shifting when we have more diversity across the country happening and more power structure of that oligarchy?
Yeah, if I understand your question, there's a direct correlation between an increase in racial and ethnic diversity and white supremacy. there's the sense of a perceived threat that we're losing something. My contention, when people say make America great again, I think the year they have in mind is 1952. What's going on in 1952? We're still in the boom of the post-World War II era, which is the first time the U.S. really becomes a superpower, right? We've got the nuclear bomb, economy's booming, we're rebuilding Europe, all of these things. It's prior to Brown v. Board, so we still have the right racial order. And the United States is something like 80, 90% white across the board, demographically. It's going back to that religion of whiteness and the sense of effervescence and the sense that this is the way things are supposed to be. It was very patriarchal. Men worked outside of the home. We're also getting the suburban boom at this point, right? So you could actually have a single income on a blue-collar job, right, and support a family. You're having a generation go to college on the GI Bill, all those kinds of things, right? And then, 54, 55, Emmett Till, Montgomery bus boycott, 1957, Little Rock 9. Then you get this guy, King, saying something about a dream. And then you get the 70s and all these women, you know, protesting Vietnam and all this stuff. And what's going on? Well, we need Reagan, you know. So it's so much of it is backlash to A, changing demographics, and B, the expansion of rights to people who historically were very easily or at least firmly kept in place. And the more people feel like that's why this the immigrant problem they're labeling, they're calling it an invasion. They're saying they're going to overwhelm us. They're going to take over. That's why when you listen closely, you'll hear this talk about it's essentially preserving the white race, not dilute. They want to they used to call it amalgamation back in the 1930s, in the Jim Crow era. There's this strain of people who are now, some of them in political power, who are very concerned about the dilution of white racial purity because of these black and brown invaders. So that's very real, and you're going to see the degrees of backlash and control increase as diversity increases.
So just to follow on, do you think as history repeats itself, we're going to see more like what happened in 54 and the follow-on eras, that pushback against the strength?
So I was taught in grad school, you know, a more helpful phrase than history repeats itself is that history rhymes or history echoes, because it's different. There's some differences. And the difference is I think it'll be worse. I think it'll be worse on two levels. One, in 2025, we are losing rights that we had fought for and gained. So historically, we were pushing for the right to vote, own a home anywhere, you know, have these certain rights. We got them, and now they're being taken back. That's different. And in a way, it's like more vehement. It's a snatching back. Never again, right? It's almost like the backlash. I think so much of what we're seeing right now is the backlash to having a black president ever, right? So what do I mean by that? It wasn't just, oh, let's get another Republican in office. No, let's get Donald Trump in office. Like that, this sort of, we're never going to let that happen again. That's the kind of backlash I think we're getting. And the way it's showing up is this oligarchical purge of institutions, federal and civil workers, purge of mainstream press, demonization of journalism. Tomorrow, on my Substack, I've got an article coming out called The Authoritarian Playbook, which is just pointing you to a resource called The Authoritarian Playbook, where this organization called United for Democracy went through seven practices of an authoritarian government. And among them are politicizing, you know, non-political institutions, demonizing the press, scapegoating minorities, all of these things that we can see and enumerate. And the reason why I bring all this up is I think that this is not politics as usual. The backlash we're seeing is worse in a political sense because they're truly dismantling all of our sort of democratic means of being heard. And that's what's truly scary.
All right, Jamar, on that note.
Yeah. Sleep well.
You have to remember all of the things that Jamar has in his head. He was still able to preach the sermon just a little bit ago with all of that too. Like it's both, right? So hold it all in tension. I don't want you to only go home feeling like, yes, all of that, but also remember that the spirit of justice is with us, right? Right?
I mean, the out of a darkness shines a great light. It's the degree of darkness that actually makes the light seem brighter. And this is what Christians are about. This is where we literally shine, is in these kinds of situations. So we are built for this, but I am very adamant that we can't be the light we're supposed to be if we don't understand the depth of the darkness.
And I would just say, and if we don't know even our own history, right? Because yes, there are the stories of the people who compromised and did awful things. And there's stories of, did you just decide you want to be a Christian at Oberlin College? Fantastic. Here's your suffrage card. Here's your abolition card. By virtue of the fact that you just decided to become a Christian, you have to do those two things. And we see even way back in Roman days, the Romans complaining about these Christians, feeding all the poor, welcoming the strangers, even the women are treated well. How ridiculous. What's happening there? Why is that movement growing, right? So there's been times in history where we can look back and we can see difficulties. There's also times in history we can look and say, those people had the spirit of justice and they continued to do the next right thing.
I just want to read the last paragraph here.
Please.
The same spirit of justice that empowered generations past is available to you today. It's been there for people across time whenever they needed it. It's here when you need it too. And lamentably, it's always needed. So, pause for a moment. Listen intently to the sound of your own soul and the echoes of your ancestors. Listen closely enough, and you'll hear a still small voice encouraging you to declare your dignity and stand up for righteousness. The spirit of justice still speaks.
Amen. God bless you, Jamar. Thank you all for coming. Let's give Jamar a big round of applause. Thank you so much for being with us.